You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On today's television review, I'm joined by Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for the Daily Telegraph newspaper here in London. On the show, we'll be chewing over the latest Netflix hit crime documentary series Making a Murderer, the BBC's lush new costume drama, an adaptation of Tolstoy's War and Peace, and we'll discuss what might be in store for us in the newly announced second series of Amazon Prime's sci-fi thriller, The Man in the High Castle. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review. Stick around. In today's show with the latest Netflix hit Making Murderer, which was just released before Christmas on the online streaming platform. The 10-part series tells the real-life tale of Stephen Avery, a man who spends 18 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit. But that is just the beginning of the story, as he is accused of murder just 2 years after his release.
Penny Bernstein was everything that Stephen wasn't. So just think of the two of them side by side.
There was no real investigation done by the sheriff's department.
The sheriff told the DA not to screw this case up. He wanted Avery convicted of this crime.
There isn't one iota of physical evidence in this case that connects Stephen Avery to it. In fact, the sheriff was told by the police, you have the wrong guy.
It's all very dark and murky and very, very fascinating. Alice, welcome to the show. Now, without giving too much away, why don't you begin by just filling us in on how the story sort of starts to unravel here?
Well, it's a bit like Serial, if you're familiar with that podcast, which looked into a kind of a retro murder case and was very big last year. And what that does is it uses evidence and film footage from the kind of the scene of the crime and from, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it uses real evidence, real footage, things from court. There's not actually that many talking heads. So you're kind of left to sort of watch and work things out without much of a helping hand from Netflix.
So I'm fascinated to know how they managed to make this so incredibly interesting that it becomes such a huge hit, because the concept of making a documentary about a crime that happened decades ago or may or not have happened, for instance, that's nothing new. You can flick onto any sort of cable network pretty much anywhere in the world now and find these documentaries that are always made in the same sort of style, you know, someone sitting in front of a background somewhere in a studio just talking about what happened when they investigated this thing 15 years ago. Why is this one so good?
I think it's partly in its deployment. So Netflix, you know, in more commanding of internet broadcasting, they released the first episode on YouTube as well. And they also released it over the holiday season or over Christmas, when there are lots of people sitting at home. And importantly, a lot of celebrities sitting at home who were tweeting frantically about it.
Interesting.
So very quickly, it sort of, well, to use a pun, it snowballed. Very quickly over that season, when people had a lot of time to sit around, and before you knew it, there were Reddit forums and Twitter discussions, and it's going to the High Court and the White House are interested. And I think it's real life implications that have also made it fascinating and made it a phenomenon. It's a perfect storm of internet and broadcasting and real life implication.
Even in the age of online streaming, scheduling still matters. Now, you did mention Serial there a little bit earlier on, and I'm fairly tempted to say that this sort of show probably wouldn't have attracted the sort of following and reaction that it has without the Serial bandwagon. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you're completely right with that. I think it's interesting that you said that it had, you know, you can go onto any kind of crime cable channel and find this kind of thing, and you're completely right. And Serial was a phenomenon that just took off without anyone expecting it. And now the first thing people have said with Making a Murderer is, it's like Serial. So you've got a captive audience there. People kind of know what they're going to expect.
Now, this is the first major documentary hit for Netflix. They're probably better associated with scripted drama and comedy series. We've had Kimmy Schmidt fairly recently. We all know House of Cards. Of course, Narcos was the other huge hit from last year. Should we look out for more major non-fiction series from them going forward?
It's really interesting because although this will be the one that everyone will be, oh, it's Netflix's documentary, it's not their first. Last year, they released something called Chef's Table, which kind of, we thought, oh, it might be a bit like Gyro Dreams of Sushi, which is a very brilliant Japanese documentary about this wonderful sushi chef. And it wasn't very good. It was this kind of slightly flabby, parsimonious, you know, thing about chefs. And, oh, no, aren't they brilliant and wonderful? And it was just a bit boring.
It felt very niche, didn't it? These little self-contained little portraits. Very, very nicely made, but probably not of the mainstream sort of appeal that one has come to expect from a behemoth like Netflix.
Exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. And I think that whatever they've learned from that was that, oh, maybe it's too niche or whatever, they've gone completely the opposite direction. There's no arty filmmaking. There's no sort of pompous, difficult to get into weird restaurants in the Alps. It's we're in Milwaukee. We're dealing with rough and ready court crimes and people are really into it.
Well, personally, I don't mind the idea of a hard-to-get-into restaurant in the Alps, especially when compared with crime-ridden Milwaukee. Let's not give away the ending of what's happening here in Making a Murderer, but were you satisfied with how things wrapped up?
I haven't got that far yet. I've been pacing myself. I'm trying. It's very difficult.
That's good. It means you cannot give away the ending.
I can't give away the ending. No, I'm a few episodes in, and I've got to admit, I don't really see what all the fuss is about. I'm finding it quite heavy going, and I feel like they could do what they are doing in a lot less. But it's very difficult to avoid spoilers. They are all over the internet.
Making a Murderer is out now on Netflix. Next up, let's discuss the BBC's major new drama series. It's an adaptation of Leo Tolstoy's novel War and Peace, set in the early 19th century. Now, this is a six-part series which debuted on Sunday night to 6 million strong audience. Now, it seems to have been extremely well received so far. Alice, firstly, what did you make of the first episode?
I felt like the first episode was a bit like going to a party and having so much fun that you feel terrible afterwards. It was really, really fun. I was a little bit sick afterwards.
Is this a positive review? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, no, it was gorgeous. It was luscious. It was very, you know, flamboyant and beautiful on the eyes. But it was a bit too many kind of too period costume drama for me personally.
A little bit too much of the bubbly on offer. Okay, so let's hear a clip of War and Peace.
You seem to have the gift of happiness.
Well, don't we all have it? Somewhere within us.
I've never experienced anything like it before.
You are Count Bezukhov now.
It is for the young ladies to make themselves pleasing to you now.
Does it frighten you?
Not a bit. I love it.
I'm in love, my friend.
I challenge you!
Flamboyance indeed. Alice, it's a Sunday evening costume drama, and some have said that it is, well, it might be a good replacement for the Downton spot. Now, look, I'm not sure what your attitude towards this is, but coming from Australia, we have in the past viewed BBC costume dramas as being a little bit stiff, maybe a little bit old-fashioned, a little bit fuddy-duddy. That seems to have changed since Downton Abbey made such waves internationally. Would you think that's a fair assessment? How does it match up to the whole Downton phenomenon?
It's interesting because Downton, I mean, I think in a lot of people's minds, Downton is the kind of a lovable soap now. You know, it's certainly a costume drama, but yeah, they've sort of sexed it up a little bit and there are all these shocking scenes and it has just become like a little like EastEnders in frocks, really.
It's made the humble soap opera okay.
Yeah, well, maybe. Or maybe it's just that it's got too soapy and it's probably best it died when it did at Christmas. The interesting thing, there has, however, been a phenomenon with costume dramas, with the likes of, you know, the partnerships between BBC and American companies getting involved. So this was produced with Weinstein. The other major one was Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall last year. And it's kind of these, producing these costume dramas which are actually very clever and thoughtful. They're not just about the frocks. They are modern in their approach.
Now, obviously, War and Peace is quite a large book. It's often become a bit of a joke, actually, to reference something that is quite long. It's not exactly War and Peace. Well, this is War and Peace, but adapting it to the screen, it had to be slashed in half just to try and fit it into the time frame.
Right.
Is that evident, at least so far?
You know, I have not read War and Peace, and I'm not even ashamed. No, I haven't. Got a first class English degree, but no War and Peace, you know. I feel that what Andrew Davies has done and what he has said has done is that there are a lot of kind of slightly dry subplots, which he just had no shame in getting rid of completely. And instead, he's focused on the kind of four key young, beautiful characters who fall in love and go to war, and the kind of ones that you'll know even if you haven't read War and Peace, which I think is a good idea.
Now, Downton's Sunday slot is to be taken over for the next 6 weeks by this programme. So it's demanding that we think about society, history, ideals. It is taking us back to 19th century Russia. How does that sort of fit in with the whole BBC family, though? Because it's a little bit different to what we've seen in the past, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it isn't that we haven't seen a War and Peace production since 1972, but also, you know, it's just like Pride and Prejudice. It's just like the occasional Dickens reboots they did. I mean, only last autumn, BBC did a series of 19th century adaptations of great literary books. So it's not that different. I'd say the big difference is that because of the American money coming in, it's a lot more of a feast for the eyes than
exactly.
We used to.
Quite interesting there, because one of the major factors for the success of this show will be how it is appeals to the American audiences. Mm. What are your thoughts on how that might play out? Because American audiences tend to embrace American fare a little bit more than foreign shows.
It's interesting because it is very British. In fact, one of the complaints or musings that's been made about it is like, what are the Russians going to think? Everyone's got these sort of quite plummy British accents. You could be mistaken for thinking it was sort of taking place in Cheshire or something. I don't know what the Americans will make of it. I'd imagine they probably like it.
Well, War and Peace is showing now on BBC One on Sunday evenings and, of course, on the BBC iPlayer as well, and will reach American screens on the 18th of January, where it will premiere simultaneously on Lifetime, A&E and History. Well, we'll end today's programme with the announcement of a second series of the Amazon Prime drama, The Man in the High Castle, which imagines what life might be like if the Nazis had won the Second World War. It's based on the novel by Philip K. Dick. Alice, before we talk about what might happen in the second series, perhaps just fill us in, wind us back, what happened in the first?
Well, so the first came out in November on Amazon, and that's why I'm kind of cautious about saying too much about what happened in the first, because although there's lots of people who are excited about spoilers for the second, I'm not entirely sure everyone is. But long and short of it is that we are in an alternative universe where the Germans and the Nazis have won the Second World War. They've bombed Washington, and now America is divided down the middle. Half of it goes to the Germans, and the western half, the western half has gone to the Japanese. And so the Axis powers are running America.
Well, let's hear a short clip from the first series of The Man in the High Castle.
Hey. Hey, what is this?
It's newsreel film.
Yeah, I see that.
It shows us winning the war.
But we didn't win the war.
That's what they told us.
Jesus, I know what this is.
What?
The Man in the High Castle.
Who?
Some guy Ed told me about it. He makes these anti-fascist movies.
Makes them. GIs in Times Square.
No, I know. They look real.
Yeah, they look real because they are real.
Whatever they are, Hitler ordered them all destroyed.
Why? They're just stupid movies.
The point is, possessing them is treason.
It's such an interesting premise, but it's so bizarre as well, isn't it? Now, the second series was announced a few days ago. I feel a little bit cruel asking you this. Do we have any idea on where the storyline might be heading?
I can speak in vague terms. I feel that, one thing that Amazon has done so well this series is the world building. So, you know, the TV commercials, the products available, you know, nooks and crannies of streets. It really does look like, you know, this horrible dystopian nightmare if America was run by the Axis powers. And I'd be both surprised if they didn't, and I'm intrigued to see what the rest of the world looks like. You know, which powers look after England now? You know, who is France run by? What is Asia doing? And I wouldn't be surprised if that's where the second season goes. And obviously more developments in the kind of the tussle between Japan and Germany, who are currently in, you know, the end of the first series, are very much on fractious relationships.
Now, of course, this is also based on a novel, so there will be plenty of people out there who have some concept of where things are actually heading here.
Sure.
But do we know how closely, how loyal the series is to the original source material here?
You're really testing my my poor level of reading here today. I'm not going to lie. I think it's like any TV series. I've not read Philip K. Dick's book, so I wouldn't know myself personally. I think it is pretty loyal, though, and that's one of the things that people have been really praising Amazon, and that the kind of the fastidious attention to detail and all those sort of weird dystopian trips, which together they build this whole imagination of what Dick imagined.
Do you think, though, there is some sort of license for adaptations to sort of steer a little bit away from the source material, as we see in House of Cards,
sure,
where the American version has really had to make up its own future now because it's veering off track so far?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, actually, it's interesting you bring that up now, because over the past week there's been a real issue with George R.R. Martin, creator of Game of Thrones. We've just found out he's not going to be able to submit his new book before the new season comes out. So we're left in a situation where this is a very pertinent issue at the moment across TV generally. I think to a general extent, the minute that gets into a TV writer's hands, it's theirs to create as a new project.
Ooh, hell hath no fury like an angered television fan. The second series of The Man in the High Castle has been commissioned by Amazon Prime, but of course the release date for now remains a closely guarded secret. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thanks to my guest today, Alice Vincent. You have been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer today was Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow to talk books with Charmaine Lovegrove. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks very much for listening.